Welcome to the Southern Fried Security Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Ciccoli. It's episode number 165, I believe. I am joined by my good friend, Steve Reagan. Steve, how are you doing tonight?
Meow.
I'm good, dude. How are you?
Quit meowing at me. I came upstairs to get away from my meowing cat, and now you're meowing at me. This is like the worst.
You should have never have told me your cat was just raging meowing all over the place, because now I'm just going to slip that in.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking later. I'm like, what's that meow? I don't understand.
So we are, unfortunately, nobody else was able to join tonight. Yvette said something about something around the house. Martin is full of cold medicine, and I haven't heard from Andy in weeks. I can only assume that he has been overwhelmed by his child and is elsewhere.
Parenthood,
right. Gets in the way of podcasting. Clearly one of the downsides of children.
Do you ever think that when it's just you and I, we should get like a special theme show? Like, it's the Steve and Joe show, the Steve and Joe show. Just so people know, like, right when they tune in, it's like, oh no.
Oh, it's just Steve and Joe tonight? Well, it's going off the rails, you know, within the first 2 minutes.
Schedule? We don't keep schedules.
Yeah. So, okay, but speaking of things going off the rails or something, we have something that has never happened before in the history of the Southern Fried Security Podcast. And that is, we have a listener question that came in on the Twitter feed. And it's amazing that after like 4 years, someone has finally asked us a question. I guess that means somebody's first, listening, right?
I was going to say, first, let's recognize that this is proof we do, in fact, have listeners. That's amazing.
Yay. No, but seriously, you know, we do kind of say it at the end of every podcast. But seriously, if you guys have questions, comments, feedback, you just want to comment on a thing that we said or whatever, you know, feel free to hit us up on Twitter, especially on the official show podcast Twitter feed, because then I pull it into the Google Doc and all of that good stuff. But we did receive a question from Ed Wilson at T-A-E-M-Y-K-S. I wasn't even going to try and pronounce that on Twitter. And he asked, what should I do with expired employees that used corporate email for Twitter / Facebook / LinkedIn? Reset password and delete? And, you know, at first, I wasn't really sure how to answer this. I think a lot of it comes down to context. And you and I were talking about this in the pre-show. I know you had some thoughts on this.
So when you read the question at base, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, it's corporate email. Therefore, once they leave the corporation, they have no rights to it. So naturally, you would forward that email to a catch-all, you know, for a period of time, change the password on it so nobody can get into it from the outside, from outside of the company and everything like that. That's standard operating procedure, or at least it should be. But we all know that really doesn't happen. And sometimes, you know, you leave the company and a year later, your credentials still work perfectly. But that's a different topic. What we're talking about here is, what do you do with expired employees that used corporate email to register accounts somewhere?
Right.
Well, you shouldn't have used your corporate account. Because once you leave that corporation, ta-da, your account's gone. Poof. But there's a catch. What if that corporate account was shared? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I control CSO's Twitter feed.
Okay.
I run that. Now, there is a email and a password and two-factor authentication that goes to a certain device. If I leave the company, do I lose access to the account? Most certainly. But should they deactivate my email or the email I created for that account? No, they shouldn't. It's not really, it's not mine, it's not theirs. It's everybody who's using that account, because, you know, sales and marketing and things like this. So if you're using these corporate emails for a specific purpose and there's more than one people, you need to really look internally to see who's touching what before you start taking things down. So, for example, if I went in right now and changed the Twitter password and didn't tell anybody, I have all the things needed access-wise to approve such a change, and nobody would be the wiser until they went in to work tomorrow morning and tried to, you know, get things done.
Right.
Oops. But, you know, if I left the company and somebody was to go through and drop that password, is that okay? You know, close off that account and everything like that. Should they delete that account? No, they shouldn't.
No, but what they should definitely kick, you know, do take steps to kick you out of that account.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Most definitely. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. And going with the question here, you know, should it be a reset password and delete? Reset password is a guarantee. Yes, you should always reset the password on a shared account the minute one of the people sharing said account leaves. That should just, you know, come naturally to you. Mm-hmm. But until you're fully aware of what the ramifications are going to be, don't delete the account. Don't just immediately go through and delete it. And I've seen this happen at smaller companies where marketing teams and sales teams share one type of generic email address and it goes into a, you know, a dump all box. Somebody leaves the company and IT deletes that email and oops,
yeah,
everybody's cut off. That's the context I was talking about pre-show.
Right.
You have to kind of pay attention to what the sidebar is on that one.
Yeah. And I do want to come back to, and I, you know, obviously this is kind of a limitation based on Twitter, but particularly the reset password and delete, like, and delete is the interesting bit. So I don't know if Ed, and I guess, you know, Ed, if you listen and you have more feedback, I'm sure we will be happy to discuss this further. But like, if he's talking about deleting the account in question, so like deleting somebody's LinkedIn, I would not go that far personally. Reset password, That might be okay. Deleting somebody's like LinkedIn account, like there are ways to kind of recover that. I would not go and delete an account, particularly one, even if it had been signed up with, you know, using corporate email and all of that, I still wouldn't delete the account.
That would be no different than me leaving IDG and then deleting CSO's Twitter feed.
Mm.
I run that account. I managed it. I grew it to where it's going. I should, you know, it's my account technically.
Right.
No, not really. It's the company's account. And if I delete it, oh boy, am I in trouble. So you really have to, you know, again, it's all about context and situational complexities. I mean, no two situations are going to be the same. But yeah, I certainly wouldn't delete anything. You know,
yeah.
Don't delete the account unless you know for certain what's going to happen once you do.
But, you know, in this situation, I like the idea of kind of like resetting the password. That way, if that person comes to you and says, hey, look, I signed up for LinkedIn. I used my corporate email address, which is something I do tend to run into, like with younger employees will kind of do that, you know, because they have a stable email address and LinkedIn is a professional thing. And now I'm at a professional job and I guess we'll just sign up, you know, using a LinkedIn email address, right? Like give them the opportunity, especially if you're kind of monitoring that email account or dumping all of that stuff into one space, like give them the opportunity to come back to you and say, hey, can I get access to that LinkedIn account? Because they can set it up where, you know, you might be able to change the email address that it goes to and things along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Or more importantly, if it was set up underneath company controls, you know, as IT, you can go in, alter the email address on the account where you've changed the password, reset the password again, and then give that to the employee, and you're hands off. You're done. You know, they have control over that entire thing. It's out of your purview. You document everything and then walk away from the situation. Ta-da. They
also get their not account. A bad idea. So, yeah, I appreciate that question. It was kind of a fun little mental exercise, you know, and would definitely.
And if you happen to be listening, Ed, seriously, feel free to ping us up on Twitter if we didn't answer it fully or if you wanted, you know, additional context. You know, this is actually, if you're listening and you've got the time, Joe and I could always just, you know, interview you. That would be a really cool discussion. I mean, why not? Yeah. Come play. But the again, anybody else, seriously, we like questions like this. It gives us stuff to talk about. It's awesome.
Exactly.
Speaking of things to talk about,
we are now in the post security summer camp doldrums, where all of the big security summer camp stuff has kind of risen up and then died back down. You know, obviously there's the big Ashley Madison thing, but I don't find that particularly interesting other than it's a big data breach on a dating site. But
who's Ashley Madison?
Right.
Is she in trouble?
Probably. yeah, they were playing something about it on on the treadmill as I was running earlier today, and I just kind of changed channels and moved on. But, you know, we do have some good evergreen content, right? Some of that content that just loves to come back up. And I think it tends to come up right about the same time of the year, right as everybody's in this really slow news cycle. And that is the death of technologies. Not the death of technology, but the death of technologies, where we've got kind of two big things that have been happening lately. The first is that there's been a lot of companies who have dumped Flash. And the second is that Netflix has come out and dumped AV. Which do you want to talk about first, Steve?
Oh, let's talk about Flash. That's the one that interests me the most.
So, okay. So now... What?
Go ahead, sorry. I was just going to say long story short and then do the... But that's fine. Go for it.
Oh, yeah. So we've had a couple of folks who have come out and blocked Flash. The first being Amazon. Amazon has come out and they've dumped Flash. And there's this article on CSO Online talking about how...
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it's backwards. So Mozilla stopped Flash first.
Oh.
Amazon then said, we're going to stop accepting Flash advertising. And now Chrome is going to mirror what Mozilla did. And basically, Flash is going to be click to enable, blocked by default, which is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, but it says a lot about antiquated web technologies. So Flash has always been the love it or hate it type technology on the web. But when it comes to a security standpoint, it's a huge attack vector. And over the years, you know, numerous times you've seen Flash leveraged as a major part of a given attack or, you know, exploitation. Mm-hmm. So you have this situation where these two companies are now, you know, saying, listen, we have, you know, other technologies that do exactly what Flash is being used for. We have no reason for this plugin, and it's creating an attack surface that's just nearly impossible to protect. So we're going to do away with it. It gets blocked by default, but it's not gone. What they're doing, and like right now as we record this, I'm on Syracuse.com, and Firefox is asking me, do you want to run Adobe Flash? I can either continue blocking or allow it. And when I hit allow, it's going to say allow permanently or just now. So you can, even then, it's a temporary allowance for Flash, which gives users some control, a little too much in my opinion. But at the same time, I mean, for those of us that understand what we're doing, I mean, I think it's a good little balance right here. It's a good trade-off.
Now, but I'm interested, why do you think that that's giving users a little too much control?
When it comes to browser security, things like this, I honestly think the user should be left out of the equation and it should be in a secure state from the get-go. So I understand that users need a level of control, but there are some granular details that they should never be involved in. And if you're going to choose to block Flash, then there's a way to do blocking but allow, you know, legit websites, which is what they're giving you the option to do here. So I understand the principle behind this, but how hard is it to keep a relatively updated, you know, safe list, and that's the only thing you run with, you know, to where it's allow some, deny all. And yet the problem is because Flash is so versatile and it's used in so many ways, you know, we've seen time and time again websites that would appear on a safe list are completely pwned via Flash. They serve up malicious ads and everything like that, and that's how people get infected. So while I think it's a little too much control, I understand completely why Mozilla and Chrome are going to do this. You have to allow them to make that choice. You can't just say these sites are okay and these sites are bad because you really don't know. Right. The end run is to get rid of Flash completely. And it's the advertising vector, which is what Amazon's doing. That's why they're a part of this news cycle right now. Amazon's getting rid of Flash because it's just it's taxing on the servers. And, you know, the attack vector itself, Maria wrote a really good story about this.
Yep, and we'll put it in show notes.
Adobe will stop accepting Flash ads on its advertising network and help make the entire web more secure, security experts have said. And you know, her story basically goes, what we had her do was write a story interviewing various different experts on web security and Flash itself, talk about what's going on. And again, the move is basically overall user protection. So Amazon's on that bandwagon right now. They're definitely not shying away from this, which is good. I mean, it's something that, a lot of a lot of people have been asking for years. I mean, what was it, 2007, 2008? People were like, let's get rid of Adobe PDF and Adobe Flash because of all the problems.
Well, and, I guess in, 2000s? Oh, I should know this off the top of my head. Is it 2007, 2008 that the iPhone came out? And Apple took the stance that there will be no Flash on iOS devices. Now, bear in mind, that was not for the security aspect. That was for the power consumption and also not playing nice with Adobe. But, the point kind of still stands, which is that that was kind of, I guess, the start of the long decline, especially once smartphones took off and, Apple stood on that stance over the past six or 7 years, I guess. So then now changing directions a little bit, talking about a different technology getting dumped. AV is dead. Long live AV. Netflix has come out and said that they are dumping their antivirus. And there's an article here on Forbes written by Thomas Fox Brewster. And he calls it that it's the presages death of an industry, right? That because Netflix is dumping antivirus, it is the death of antivirus. But what he kind of goes on to say is that, you still kind of have to keep AV around because AV is required by compliance laws like PCI. And then there's the argument that AV is necessary to pick up the, quote, background noise, as analyst Bob Tarzi describes it. So, he talks about, well, it's the death of things, but there's still some pretty reasonable reasons to keep it around. And so I felt like this was kind of much ado about nothing. And Netflix even came out and said that they're leaving antivirus, but they're still using stuff that's going to be, doing other sorts of host-based detection.
What's really cute is some of their infrastructure is using appliances that have AV running live on them. And so they're taking away desktop AV, but the infrastructure itself has AV running. Signature detection, no less, which is why I giggle when I see this story come up. And I don't know, it's like you were saying, AV is extremely useful for detecting the background noise, or more to the point, it's extremely capable of picking out common variants that get shipped to people every minute of the day.
Right.
And in an industry that's heavily regulated, let's take finance, for example, AV is a requirement. You don't get away without having it. You have to have it. And it's not a bad thing. So I find it really funny when companies are like, we're getting rid of AV, it doesn't work. And yet, these are going to be the people, complaining when they get hit with Coob Face because they're, ultra smart. Their ultra smart, threat intelligence center didn't know that Coob Face was a malware variant that, came out years before Zeus. And they're flabbergasted. How did this get on the system? And why is it posting to Facebook all the time? I could just see that, that conversation going on. And there will be people completely sideblinded by that. But yeah, it's AV is not dead. It's a billion-dollar industry. There's no way it's going anywhere.
But right, and I agree with the sentiment, right? Evaluating whether a tool is effective for your environment is definitely something that companies should be doing often. Determining what your return on investment is and that sort of thing. Which, of course, saying ROI brings up a whole nother can of worms that I really don't want to get into.
But isn't that the problem? AV is a tool that you can evaluate fully, determine it's completely useless in your organization, and you still get to keep it because you're regulated.
Right. True.
I mean, again, you're stuck between a rock and a hard spot because you have regulators and assessors coming in going, where's your AV? Oh, well, sorry, you failed this assessment because you don't have AV. I'm sorry you feel it's worthless, but why is your Facebook posting all those messages? Are you guys running a social media campaign? What is that? Why is it on my wall? And it's just going to keep going because, you know, again, it may be ineffective for your organization, but if you want to keep that compliance, you're going to have to. But that takes you into the whole compliance. It's not security. And we could do a show on that one entirely.
I think we've done multiple shows on that one, come to think of it.
But I mean, that's I completely agree with you. You know, every tool should be evaluated, you know, if not annually, semi-annually. And, you know, is it fitting? Does it make sense to keep investing in this? But unfortunately, you know, part of the reason AV is such a billion-dollar industry is because you need it to keep compliance in some cases. So it's there, right, regardless of what you think about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. So with that, we've kind of run up into the end of, you know, kind of this slow news cycle. Kind of a short week this week.
Here's something funny, since we're kind of at the end, but we still have a little couple minutes left. What have you heard about the privacy stuff in Windows 10? Do you think businesses should be concerned about that?
Man, that's Microsoft a tough one. Microsoft tracking
key logs and everything else. You know, what about companies using Windows 10 and, you know, it's tracking emails, it's archiving this content and everything, which it does state in their terms of service that, you know, they catalog emails, keystrokes, things like this, monitor license usage and everything. What's it say about a company developing source code and software, proprietary information, if all of that's going to a place that you can't control?
You know, that's a tough one. Full disclosure, I'm using Windows 10 on my home gaming PC. You know, I think I did the upgrade the day it became available. And then all the privacy stuff started coming out, and I wondered about my decision. But
it's a good operating system. It is a good operating system. Yeah, server I've got running right here. But
from a business perspective, that's, you know, I feel like now Microsoft, as far as I know, has not begun really rolling out Windows 10 into a corporate environment, right? It is only an upgrade option if you're not on enterprise. So, you know, these are home users that are experiencing these things. I've got to believe that, especially in like the GPO settings and things along those lines, they're going to be making that an option to turn all that stuff off. And companies will have to carefully evaluate and make sure it is actually being turned off. You know,
that puts so much overhead on IT right now.
Absolutely. I
mean, they're already understaffed, under budgeted, and are underfunded, and they're overworked like you would not believe. And now they get to do this. They get to monitor their own vendor.
Right. That's
wow.
I've got to believe that, you know, we may see not like a full on service pack one, but perhaps the privacy update or whatever Microsoft wants to spin it, that really kind of brings some of this stuff to the forefront. You know, you have to go into
your privacy.
Yeah. You know, oh, this is our update that we say, oops. Because, you know, they do present you with a screen that says, you know, here are some of your privacy options. Do you want us to send this? Do you want us to send this? Do you want us to send this? And that is like the tip of the iceberg as far as what they're collecting. And there are like registry key entries that have to be changed and things along those lines to really, you know, neuter all of the callback stuff.
Early on, some of the people on Reddit started posting up pre-configured host files that you can use that were supposedly going to dev null the callouts that Windows 10 was making. And they completely neglected the fact that a lot of these callouts are hard-coded into the apps themselves and into the operating system, where it bypasses hosts entirely. It just goes on its own. and there's nothing you can do. Like, even registry modifications aren't stopping it. And it's because it's hard-coded, so unless you really, 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 you know, want to just destroy the operating system, or for most part delete Windows, you know, Sys32 and just be done with it, you're hosed. I mean, you're going to have to accept the fact that, you know, this is what it is. And even when you pay for the product, you're still the product in some cases.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that if you are a privacy, like if you are a person who is that sort of levels of privacy is critical to you, Windows 10 should not be your operating system, period. End of story.
Well, anybody that's that deep into it, they're not on Windows to begin with.
Right. You know, going forward, I think businesses will definitely have to carefully evaluate how they're how they choose to deploy Windows 10 in their environment. I know even starting in the first week or so on Reddit, particularly our sysadmin, which is actually a source for some really great security content. You know, folks were talking about working on it in their lab environments and like evaluating how it would work. And then once the privacy stuff started coming up, you know, the tone shifted a bit and people started trying to figure this stuff out. So, you know, going forward, it's going to be interesting to kind of see where it is. I wouldn't start using it in a business situation, especially if you're working on proprietary source code, if you're working with PHI or PII. You know, no Windows 10 on classified systems, you know, things along those lines.
Well, see, and that's the thing. When you branch out into those areas, you know, particularly in the defense sector, or actually anywhere in the DIB, Microsoft's going to have to come up with something or clearly explain what it is they're collecting and how. Because when you read the user license agreement, mm-hmm. it's kind of straightforward, but not really. And that's going to leave a lot of people in the dark. That's part of the fear and hype around Windows 10 is, while it's explained what it's doing, that doesn't really explain why or how. And Microsoft's really going to have to explain to the, like places like, you know, sectors like the DIB to, here's what it is, here's why it is, because otherwise there's no way they're going to put Windows 10 on that.
Absolutely. So I think it will definitely be interesting to see kind of where it goes from here. Especially, I believe it's October-ish. I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's October-ish that they're talking about starting the rollout for enterprise customers. I'm not sure about that off the top of my head, but that's coming up quick. So if I were Microsoft, I would be scrambling to figure out how we can make sure that, you know, DoD will actually use our, we'll use our brand spanking new operating system and things along those lines.
But on the home front, Microsoft has been successful. There are 75 million Windows 10 users currently.
Really?
According to Reddit. Yep.
It was a pretty painless upgrade process, I will say that. Very Apple-esque as far as the upgrade process goes.
I had one of the bunk video cards, and I got the Windows error.
Oh.
Which you'd have to scroll back through my pictures on Twitter, but you'll see I actually tweeted it. And it was like this error screen that was just like, something has gone wrong. And I'm like, great. Thanks.
Error, something happened or something like that?
Yeah. Like, error, something happened. I'm like, really? Do tell. But that's all you got. And it's like, oh.
Yeah. So with that, though, we are now bumping up against our time limit. So good job pushing us forward a little bit there, buddy. So, Steve, if people wanted to read your writings or get in touch with you, where might they be able to do that?
You can find me on Twitter, SteveD3. And, of course, I am the senior staff writer at CSO, but you'll find me all across the IDG network. But the easiest place is to watch me on Twitter because I post what I write.
There we go. You can find show notes for this episode at southernfriedsecurity.com/165. You can find the show Twitter account at SFS Podcast on Twitter. Please feel free to reach out to us with questions and comments and feedback and stuff. If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me at J Sicoli on Twitter. And with that, I think we're going to call it a night.
Night, everybody.